And welcome back to the Discovering Truth series. I'm Rick Tokini. This is our continuing dialogue on one of the most challenging issues today, the difficulty of determining truth in a world of exploding information and data. I'm Rick Tokini, along with our host and show creator, Tim Love. And Tim is the former vice chairman of Omnicom Group, the leading U.S. marketing and advertising services holding company. And Tim, you have on today one of our personal heroes, Dr. Jane Goodall, the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute. I got to ask you, Tim, what was the motivation to have on one of our personal heroes, Dr. Jane Goodall?
Well, I was on the board of directors of the Heart of America Foundation, which our mutual friend Bill Hallamandaris founded with his wife, Angie. And for years, in addition to Jane being on the board, Christopher Reeve and some other people that I admired. But I always admired Jane and her outlook and the work that she's done to make the world a better place. And it occurred to me that this idea of discovering truth is so fundamental that I'd really be curious to know what she thinks about it, given the struggles she has had to get people to be more concerned about wildlife, about nature, about the environment. And she's devoted her whole life to that and made a real difference. But she must have had times where she had to overcome misinformation, personal attacks by people who felt threatened by her her work. And I just thought I'd really like to know what she thinks. She's also a UN messenger for peace or for hope. Mm-hmm. And she's had to confront this pandemic, which I don't know if you know this or not, but she's been traveling about 300 days a year on average, and she's 86.
Amazing.
And she, this has put a real crimp in her way of reaching out to people. And so she's realizing that she can still communicate and still make a difference using the technology that we're using today in podcasting and Zoom and FaceTime and Skype and all these other things. And she's going to be coming out with her own podcast series. It's going to be called Hopecast. So I felt that I was just my curiosity to have her come speak was really the whole thing. She's a hero to me too.
Well, I'm going to let you complete the intro on Jane as we welcome Jane to Discovering Truth.
Thanks, Rick. Understanding people and understanding ideas. In earlier episodes, we've talked about how our Twitter world of social media is shifting the power of information from prior authorities to individuals who create their own content, thus raising the concern over who has the real authority for truth today. The situation continues to be made more challenging by new threats to society, the coronavirus, and a proven increase in foreign and political misinformation. Today's guest is Jane Goodall, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, a UN messenger of peace, and Dame Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. Ms. Goodall is a lifelong advocate for truth and global citizenship through her studies as an ethologist, which deals with the human character and its formation and evolution. She is best known for her exceptionally detailed and long-term research on the chimpanzees of Gombe Stream National Park in Tanzania. Now in its 60th year, she is a world-famous spokesperson for animal rights as well as human rights. was interested in animal behavior from an early age. She left school at age 18 and worked as a secretary and as a film production assistant until she gained passage to Africa. Once there, Jane began assisting paleontologist and anthropologist Louis Leakey. Her association with Leakey led eventually to her establishment in 1960 of a camp so that she could observe the behavior of chimpanzees in the region. In 1964, she married a Dutch photographer who had been sent by the National Geographic in 1962 to Tanzania to film her. The University of Cambridge in 1965 awarded Ms. Goodall a PhD in ethology. Except for short periods of absence, Jane remained in Tanzania until 1975, often directing the fieldwork of other doctoral candidates. In 1977, she co-founded the Jane Goodall Institute for Wildlife Research, Education, and Conservation. She has also created various other initiatives, including two sanctuaries for orphan wild chimpanzees and Take Care, a community-centered conservation program now active in six African countries. In 1991, Dr. Goodall founded Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots, a humanitarian and environmental program for young people of all ages, empowering them to become involved in hands-on programs for the community, animals, and the environment we all share. Over the years, Dr. Goodall was able to correct a number of misunderstandings about chimpanzees. She found, for example, that the animals are omnivorous, not vegetarian, that they are capable of making and using tools. In short, they have a set of hitherto unrecognized, complex, and highly developed social behaviors. Jane wrote a number of books and articles about various aspects of her work. In 2002, she was appointed a UN Messenger of Peace. The recipient of numerous awards and honors, Jane has been the subject of numerous films and documentaries, including Jane, a National Geographic documentary released in 2017, and The Hope, which aired on International Earth Day this past April. She recently was featured in a CNN interview by Anderson Cooper, who highlighted Jane's perspective on the coronavirus. Jane has been a leading advocate of peace in the global village. Her key theme is in warning us that the greatest danger to our future is apathy. Welcome, Jane. It's an honor to have this opportunity to get your insights on discovering truth.
Well, thank you, Tim and Rick. And it seems that this is a very appropriate time for a series with this name. We certainly need hope today.
Yes. I'd like to start with a question about your institute. The Jane Goodall Institute is about inspiring hope through action. And I'd like to quote your vision of the institute because I found it very inspirational. And that is, quote, "Our vision is a healthy planet where people make compassionate choices to live sustainably, in harmony with each other, other animals, and the environment we all share." Jane, could you please share with us the truths that you see about our planet and living in harmony with people, animals, and the environment?
Well, you know, I have indeed lived on this planet for 86 years, and I've seen massive change in almost everything. I mean, when I was growing up, there wasn't television, there wasn't laptops. I mean, you know, I had pencil, paper, and books, which is when my passion for going to Africa began, because I read the story of Dr. Doolittle and Tarzan of the Apes, and I dreamed that I'd grow up, go to Africa, live with wild animals, and write books about them. Everybody laughed. World War II was raging. I was just a girl, didn't have any money. But my mother said, if you really want to do this, then you have to work extremely hard. You have to take advantage of every opportunity. But above all, if you don't give up, you may find a way. So that's, you know, I always want to recognize the importance of supporting your child in what that child wants to do. 10 to 1, it'll change, but mine didn't. And yes, I got to Gombe, and it was while I was out in the rainforest on my own that I really came to understand how all living things are interconnected and how every species has a role to play, no matter how small and insignificant. And the loss of one species can have a ripple effect because that may have been the main food source of another species and so on, and it can actually lead to ecosystem collapse. Wow. And so during these years that I've been on the planet, I've seen so much destruction, so many rainforests destroyed, so much pollution, pollution of the water, the air, and the land, pollution of the soil with chemical pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and so on. And so much suffering. Yeah. And as I first of all began to learn about the chimpanzees and how close they are to us in their behavior, and of course they share 86.2% of their DNA with us. Mm. And when I'd been in the field 2 years, I had never been to college. We couldn't afford it. And when I got there, I was horrified to be told I should have given the chimpanzees numbers, not names. And I couldn't talk about them having personalities, minds capable of solving problems, and certainly not emotions like happiness, sadness, fear, and so on. But when I was a child, I had a wonderful teacher, and he taught me that indeed animals do have personalities, minds, and feelings, and we're not separate from the animal kingdom. We're part of it. That teacher was my dog. And of course, if you share your life in a meaningful way with an animal, you know that we're not the only beings with personality, mind, and emotion. Yes. So I was able to stand up to the professors. I learned at Cambridge how to sort out my what I believed and put it in a scientific form. And I got my PhD that Lewis Leakey had insisted I get. And went back to Gombe and went on learning. And I think that because chimps are so like us, because the Geographic sent out a photographer, Hugo van Lawick, and his film documented all these things that at first a lot of scientists said, well, why should we believe this young girl? Tool using and tool making had been supposed to be unique to humans. And he documented the emotions of the chimpanzees, the grief shown by a mother when her child died.
Oh, boy. What an emotional thing to learn and experience.
Yes. Well, I think because of that, it opened up this reductionist way of thinking. So today, scientists are actually studying animal mind, emotion, and personality. And we know now the intelligence of animals is so much greater than was thought when I went to Cambridge. You know, we know about the intelligence of elephants and whales and, well, so many different animals, mice and rats. Rats are incredibly intelligent, pigs as well. And so we know that birds are amazingly intelligent. The octopus, unbelievable what they can do. And so it's a whole new way of thinking about animals, which the chimpanzees helped me to put through to science. And I think that was the first major accomplishment of my life. But then, of course, wanting to help protect the chimpanzees and the forests where they live and learning more and more about our destruction of the natural world, which is why in 1986 I left Gombe and started traveling around and talking to people about what was going on, at the same time learning more and more about what we were doing to the planet in the developed world. And doing all of this, learning more and more about the destruction in Africa, it was pretty grim.
Yeah.
And at a conference where we talked about the environmental situation, the habitat destruction of the chimps, and the ways in which sometimes they are treated in captive situations, especially back then it was medical research. And I left that conference completely changed. I was an activist. I had to try and do something. Mm. And so during that time, and if I summarize it now, all these years later, there are four major problems which are truths in this world that we somehow have to solve, no matter how difficult that may seem. And first of all, poverty alleviation. Because if you're really poor, you're going to cut down the last tree because you're desperate to grow more food to feed your family.
Yes.
And you're going to cut down the forest to, as your population expands, because you need more land for you and your cattle.
Yeah.
And the second problem is the unsustainable lifestyles of so many, many hundreds and millions of people on this planet. We have more than we need. So many people don't think about what they're doing. They don't think about what they buy. Do they really need it? Is it harming the environment to produce it? Did it lead to animal suffering? Is it cheap because of child slave labor? And so our unsustainable lifestyle can be changed once we get a sufficient volume of people to make those changes. And then the third problem, today it's estimated 7.2 billion people on the planet, and already we're using up natural resources faster in some places than nature can replenish them. And it's estimated in 2050 there will be 9.7 billion people on the planet. So what's going to happen? I'm not going to even try to answer that, except to remind people that one child in an affluent society will use sometimes as much as 10% more of the natural resources than a child growing up in poverty in Asia or Africa.
Wow.
And then, of course, the final thing that we have to solve is corruption. It's rife everywhere. And until we've tried to solve these four problems, which are true, all of them, then if we don't, then if we carry on with business as usual, it's going to be the end of us. We need the natural environment. We depend on it for clean air and water. And so that's why I started Roots and Shoots, our program for young people, because I found they were losing hope. They were angry. They were depressed, or they were just apathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they told me, well, you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. We've actually been stealing their future. We still are. Mm. But there is something that can be done. And Roots and Shoots is about taking action. The Jane Goodall Institute is about taking action. We try to alleviate poverty in seven different African countries around chimpanzee habitat, help them to find alternative ways of living without destroying the environment. And the Roots and Shoots groups, now in 65 countries, kindergarten, university, everything in between, hundreds and thousands of groups. And each group chooses three projects to make the world better for people, for animals, for the environment, because everything is interconnected.
That's a great program, and really agree with you. It's needed. You know, I hadn't planned to ask this question, but you made me think about the connection of animals and the usage of natural resources. I don't know the answer to this question, but are you aware of any problems that wind energy has with killing birds or anything like that? I've only heard it from one place, and it doesn't hold true to me.
You heard it. Well, of course, occasionally a bird will get killed, just like birds are sometimes killed on power lines or flying into windows.
Sure.
We can probably do more to save birds by forcing buildings, particularly tall ones, offices, to turn their lights off at night, and that does make a difference.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's so much we can do to improve things in the world. And sometimes people accuse those of us who care about the environment of being tree huggers.
Yes.
I don't mind. I have hugged trees. I love trees.
I have too. I thanked somebody once for calling me that.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Well, nobody's ever called me that to my face, but you know, behind my back, and I know exactly some people who would do that.
I know you've been traveling an average of about 300 days a year from talking with your administrative assistant, and you have such a strong message of optimism and hope, and it seems to be more relevant with each passing day. You've had a front row seat watching the natural world change, as you just articulated, and watching humankind demolish and then rebuild entire ecosystems. What is the source of your optimism today, and how are you keeping this message vital during this time of travel restrictions and isolation?
Well, I've got four reasons for hope. And the first one is that youth program I talked about.
Yes, Roots and Shoots.
Yep. Yeah, when young people know the problem and we listen to them and empower them to take action, what they're doing now, they are, as we speak, there are groups saving the world, although it's pretty hard for most of them when they're locked down to do what yes. they need to do. So hopefully one day they'll be able to go back to doing things in groups, because that's what gives them, you know, energy.
Yes.
The second reason for hope is the resilience of nature. It's unbelievable. Places we have destroyed can once again become green and support life. And I see so many examples of that as I'm going around the world. So many people I meet who are just doing incredible things and restoring ecosystems and restoring forests and protecting forests and giving animals on the brink of extinction another chance. You know, I've got so many stories about all those things. And then there's this brain. The problem is with us today is there seems to be a disconnect between this unbelievable intellect that we have and the heart, human love and compassion. And I truly think that unless head and heart work in harmony, we'll never attain our true human potential. Because, you know, think of what scientists have done. Amazing things. Mm-hmm. Sending a rocket up to the moon, up to Mars, with a robot taking photographs. Yeah. We know we can't live there.
Right.
So how is the most intellectual species ever destroying its only home because of this disconnect between head and heart? So, my final reason for hope is what I call the indomitable human spirit, the people who tackle what seems impossible and won't give up. So, you know, there is even a silver lining with this COVID-19 pandemic, mm-hmm. and that is that more people are aware of the fact that it's our destruction of the natural world that's and our disrespect of animals that's actually led to this pandemic. It was predicted, it's been predicted for so long. Mm-hmm. And certainly some of these epidemics and pandemics have come from very cruel treatment of animals as well as destruction of the natural world. So if you cut down a lot of forests, a lot of animals come closer together who wouldn't have been in contact before. That enables a virus or a bacteria to spill over into another species where it's different. And then animals are pushed into closer contact with people. And these viruses, I think the ones that jump over from an old traditional host into a new animal, maybe they're more active. I don't know. I'm not a virologist, but anyway.
Yeah.
And jump over. But then in addition, wild animals, we hunt them, kill them, eat them, traffic them, sell them off to these wild animal meat markets in Asia, the bush meat markets in Africa. Yeah. And these create perfect environments for the viruses and bacteria to spill over, as they have, it's been shown. And then finally, those are terribly cruel and totally awful and shameful factory farms where billions of animals are now crammed together in often unsanitary conditions. That too has led in several cases to epidemics.
Yes.
Because the virus has spilled over.
And, yeah, and it's not just in a third world country. It's in the United States where these farms exist too.
Yes, everywhere. And in fact, it was one farm in, I think it was Iowa, mm-hmm. that led to one of these epidemics. It was from cattle. And another one in factory farm pigs in Asia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're just, there's a cruel streak in us. And it all ties into what I was saying. Animals have, they're sentient. They're not just things put here for us to use and abuse. Yeah. And when people talk about a factory farm and the cruelty to pigs, I think it's not cruelty to billions of pigs. Each pig has a life. Each pig has feelings and can feel fear and distress. And it's the individuals in all of these situations. It's so easy to think of a mass of animal and a mass of humanity. But we're all made up of individuals with our own will to live, to quote Albert Schweitzer.
I saw something in the news yesterday that the air pollution index has improved by 17% with this pandemic, and it brings to reality a lot of things that we might have doubted, but just in that short time, we're seeing an improvement.
Yeah, and think, you know, the one, of course, there's leaders around the planet. I won't mention names, but there are certain leaders itching to get back to business as usual and start up the economy. In fact, even probably too soon.
Yes.
And, you know, China's opened up coal mines. President Trump wants to go into coal energy.
Yeah.
And Bolsonaro wants to chop down forests, all for economic development. So again and again, economic development is put ahead, protecting the environment for the future. And I say it again, we need the natural environment. We depend on it for clean air, clean water, food, and all the rest of it. And spiritually, there's something about nature that we need for our spirit.
Yeah.
And so my hope, again, is that there'll be enough billions of people, well, certainly millions, from the big cities, who probably never before had the luxury of breathing clean air.
Right.
Or looking up and seeing stars bright in a night sky.
Yeah.
And although right now, with the kind of leaders we have, with the swing to the far right, maybe this won't make, they won't be able to make too much difference. Although I think millions and millions of people want change. I hear it everywhere. But my hope is that the groundswell will grow and grow, and parents will tell their children until there's a force of people that, first of all, make a difference by not buying products from companies that are harming the environment, consumer pressure, and enough pressure that governments will have to change.
Yeah. Well, I think the message is getting there, and it may not be happening fast enough, but you've had such a wonderful impact on all of us. And I wanted to go back to something that you were saying about the emotions and the similar feelings that you've observed in animals. And to this day, I think you're the only human being ever accepted into chimpanzee society. So you can communicate with them. You must be able to communicate with them. And my question is, do chimpanzees always tell the truth? What have you observed about the concept of truth and trust in your studies that can help us today?
Unfortunately, chimpanzees are a bit too like us, or we're a bit too like them. And they actually can lie. That's been shown in, it depends how you define lying, but even at Gombe, there was one young chimp, and it was in the days when we were feeding bananas, and he was young, so he often didn't get a share, and that upset him a lot. And if he was in a group and all the big males and the adult females that had all the bananas, if a chimp gets up and looks purposeful, there's some good food over there. the others will very often follow. So this young chimp figure, and he did this three times. He got up, jauntily walked off, looking back over his shoulder, and his mother followed, and then the others followed, and the whole group set off. 10 minutes later, he came back, and of course he got some bananas. But it was so funny, the first time, he was, when chimps are excited, they can't help vocalizing, and of course the others came running back, he's got bananas. So the next day, the next time he did it, he came back, he got his bananas, and he put his hands over his mouth. I mean, you know. So
he knew.
He knew. So, and in captivity, chimps have been shown to lie. They actually point to food in one direction so that their companions will go off there, and then they sneak off to get the food, which they know is in another direction. So it's a sort of lying, but we've taken it to extremes.
Yes, we certainly have, and we certainly can observe that same behavior in our own circles.
This thing about truth, false fake news. I'm so tired of it. I'm out on the internet. There's so much that's not true. And
I know.
People who, especially uneducated people, and some parts of society in US and UK have been deliberately undereducated to suppress them. We know that. And so they don't know what's true and what isn't true. They don't know who to believe.
No, I know that. Do you recommend, what would you recommend for people to be better at determining truth? I tell people, don't just watch one cable news channel. Make sure you're getting diverse points of view. Don't just listen to one radio announcer who's giving commentary every day. And yet, at the same time, we're seeing newspapers, lose some of their control to, or some of their utility to the internet, and people getting the news on the internet.
I know.
What do you advise for people?
Well, I really don't know what to advise. I mean, we work through our roots and shoots groups with the kind of advice that you've suggested. We have to find a way to somehow get onto these networks and get into these particular streams of information and put the truth across. But it's very difficult to do that because people who believe the lying ones among us don't want to hear anything different. They say we're fake news. So I don't know.
No, it's very frustrating. And some of those people are in our own families. So it's been something that has bothered me for a while. I lived outside the United States for much of my career. And so I didn't see programs like The Apprentice and things that had developed. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to examine this idea of truth. And your interview and your perspective on this is just, I so deeply am grateful to you for your being here to speak with us. And you're making a huge difference. And I hope that this podcast helps. And I can't, now you're starting a podcast series too?
Yes, we're calling it a Hopecast.
Oh,
and we launched this month. And it's going to be a discussion with some really interesting people. And we're still, trying to find out which of these people that I feel would be fabulous to have a fireside chat.
Yes.
Sometimes with a moderator and sometimes depending on how well the person and I know each other. But it should be great, I think.
It'll be called a Hopecast, and it'll have your name on it, I'm sure. And this will be available in about a month?
Well, we're announcing it this month. I think the first one will be this month, I think.
Oh, excellent.
But, I have a team of people helping from the Jane Goodall Institute in the US and the UK. So I couldn't do it all on my own.
No, I know. I just think that's wonderful. I like the, as an ex-advertising guy, I like HopeCast very much.
Oh, good. That's nice. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. Bill Halamandaris, a mutual friend of ours, suggested that I ask you something that he said that as a young girl, often during the darkest days of World War II in England, you recall listening to Winston Churchill. And how much of what he said then is relevant to our young people where we are now today?
Well, I think the reason that, I mean, we would have lost the war without Churchill. I have no, you know, I think everybody I respect who lived through that time feels the same. It was his, those great speeches. I mean, he was an orator.
Yes.
And they say Hitler was too, so there were these two orators against each other. But, you know, his famous ones that we'll fight them on the beaches, and there were the old boys coming out with their pitchforks, and we were so unprepared in England. I mean, I live on the, I'm here now in the house I grew up in, and it's on the sea, it's by the sea, Bournemouth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our protection from the might of the German Navy was a bit of scaffolding along the edge of the sea and some barbed wire. That was it.
That was it.
Yes. Then some troops came and were stationed near us, but then some American troops, which we loved because they gave us sweets. And of course, we were on rations. We couldn't get any sweets, so the children loved them. But yes. I remember his speeches, and partly because I've heard them again. So the war taught me a lot about courage, about community, and we've seen a lot of courage and community in this pandemic. The people are frontline fighting this disease, and the community is getting together to help and support each other. The Italians, did you see them out on their balconies singing opera? I mean, it was such wonderful things went on.
Yes.
You know, I do believe that a sense of humor is one of the most important things, and certainly we Brits have a sense of humor, which is very lucky. And that came to the fore in the war. I still remember some of those programs, Itmar, and all those amazing characters. So, yes, I remember quite well what was going on in the war.
Yeah. Well, it's inspirational to be with you, and the world loves you, and wish you much success with HopeCast. And again, thank you so much for giving us your time and your wisdom and your passion today. I feel blessed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me, because any opportunity to get a message out to people, and it's so important now. If people lose hope, they become apathetic and give up. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to try as hard as I can to get this message out as broadly as I can. So well, I'll say good evening, because I know it's good evening in the UK. And thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. That's great.
So, Jane, we really appreciate your insights and discussion today on Discovering Truth. And it's truly been an honor to have you on. Let me remind our listeners, if you want to access any of the Discovering Truth podcast series, you can go to iTunes, Apple Podcast. You can also hear them on Google, Deezer, Spreaker, Spotify, and CastBox. And we happen to also see them on Apple TV now as well. So we hope that you've enjoyed today's show. We certainly have. And as we always say here, may you discover the truth, listen to all sides of the issue, and measure trust. Have a great week. So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasine@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program.